Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Englishman by Guy de Maupassant. They made a circle around Judge Bermudier, who was giving his opinion of the mysterious affair that had happened at St. Cloud. For a month, Paris had doted on this inexplicable crime. No one could understand it at all. Monsieur Bermudier, standing with his back to the chimney, talked about it, discussed the divers' opinions, but came to no conclusions. Many women had risen and come nearer, remaining standing with eyes fixed upon the shaven mouth of the magistrate, whence issued these grave words. They shivered and vibrated, crisped through their curious fear, through that eager, insatiable need of terror, which haunts their soul, torturing them like a hunger. One of them, paler than the others after a silence, said, "It is frightful. It touches the supernatural. We shall never know anything about it." The magistrate turned toward her, saying, "Yes, madame. It is probable that we never shall know anything about it. As for the word supernatural, when you come to use that, it has no place here. We are in the presence of a crime skillfully conceived, very skillfully executed, and so well enveloped in mystery that we cannot separate the impenetrable circumstances which surround it. But once in my life, I had to follow an affair which seemed truly to be mixed up with something very unusual. However, it was necessary to give it up, as there was no means of explaining it." Many of the ladies called out at the same time, so quickly that their voices sounded as one, "Oh, tell us about it." Monsieur Bermudier smiled gravely, as judges should, and replied, "You must not suppose for an instant that I at least believe there was anything superhuman in the adventure. I believe only in normal causes. And if in place of using the word supernatural to express what we cannot comprehend, we should simply use the word inexplicable, it would be much better. In any case, the surrounding circumstances in the affair I'm going to relate to you, as well as the preparatory circumstances, have affected me much. Here are the facts. I was then the judge at instruction of Ajaccio, a little white town lying on the border of an admirable gulf that was surrounded on all sides by high mountains. What I particularly had to look after there were the affairs of Vendetta. Some of them were superb, as dramatic as possible, ferocious and heroic. We find there the most beautiful subjects of vengeance that one could dream of. Hatred a century old, appeased for a moment but never extinguished. Abominable plots, assassinations becoming massacres, and almost glorious battles. For 2 years I heard of nothing but the price of blood, of the terribly prejudiced Corsican, who is bound to avenge all injury upon the person of him who is the cause of it, or upon his nearest descendants. I saw old men and infants, cousins, with their throats cut, and my head was full of these stories. One day we learned that an Englishman had rented for some years a little villa at the end of the gulf. He had brought with him a French domestic picked up at Marseille on the way. Soon everybody was occupied with this singular person, who lived alone in his house, only going out to hunt and fish. He spoke to no one, never came to the town, and every morning practiced shooting with a pistol and a rifle for an hour or two. Some legends about him were abroad. They pretended that he was a high personage fled from his own country for political reasons. Then they affirmed that he was concealing himself after having committed a frightful crime. They even cited some of the particularly horrible details. In my capacity of judge, I wished to get some information about this man, but it was impossible to learn anything. He called himself Sir John Rowell. I contented myself with watching him closely, although in reality there seemed nothing to suspect regarding him. Nevertheless, as rumors on his account continued, grew, and became general, I tried to try and see this stranger myself. For this purpose, began to hunt regularly in the neighborhood of his property. I waited long for an occasion, It finally came in the form of a partridge, which I shot and killed before the very nose of the Englishman. My dog brought it to me, but immediately taking it, I went and begged Sir John Rowell to accept the dead bird, excusing myself for intrusion. He was a tall man with red hair and red beard, very large, a sort of placid, polite Hercules. He had none of the so-called British haughtiness, and heartily thanked me for the delicacy in French, were they beyond the Channel accent. At the end of a month, we had chatted together 5 or 6 times. Finally, one evening, as I was passing by his door, I perceived him astride a chair in the garden, smoking his pipe. I saluted him, and he asked me in to have a glass of beer. It was not necessary for him to repeat before I accepted. He received me with the fastidious courtesy of the English, spoke in praise of France and of Corsica, and declared that he loved that country and that shore. Then, with great precaution, in the form of lively interest, I put some questions to him about his life and his projects. He responded without embarrassment and told me that he had traveled much, in Africa, in the Indies, and in America. He added, laughing, "I have had many adventures, oh yes." I began to talk about hunting, and he gave me many curious details of hunting the hippopotamus, the tiger, the elephant, and even of hunting the gorilla. I said, "All these animals are very formidable." He laughed, "Oh no, the worst animal is man." Then he began to laugh, with a hearty laugh of a big contented Englishman. He continued, "I have often hunted man also." He spoke of weapons, and asked me to go into his house to see his guns of various makes and kinds. His drawing room was hung in black silk embroidered with gold. There were great yellow flowers running over the somber stuff, shining like fire. "It is Japanese cloth," he said. But in the middle of a large panel, a strange thing attracted my eye. Upon a square of red velvet, a black object was attached. I approached and found it was a hand, the hand of a man. Not a skeleton hand, white and characteristic, but a black, desiccated hand, with yellow joints, with the muscles bare, and on them traces of old blood, of blood that seemed like a scale, over the bones sharply cut off at about the middle of the forearm, as if with a blow of a hatchet. About the wrist was an enormous iron chain riveted, soldered to this unclean member, attaching it to the wall by a ring sufficiently strong to hold an elephant. I asked, "What is that?" The Englishman responded tranquilly, "It belonged to my worst enemy. It came from America. It was broken with a saber, cut off with a sharp stone, and dried in the sun for 8 days. Oh, very good for me, that was." I touched the human relic, which must have belonged to a colossus. The fingers were moderately long and attached by enormous tendons that held the straps of skin in place. This dried hand was frightful to see, making one think naturally of the vengeance of a savage. I said, "This man must have been very strong." With a gentleness, the Englishman answered, "Oh, yes, but I was stronger than he. I put this chain on him to hold him." I thought he spoke in jest and replied, "The chain is useless now that the hand cannot escape." Sir John Rowell replied gravely, "It always wishes to escape. The chain is necessary." With a rapid questioning glance, I asked myself, "Is he mad? Or is that an unpleasant joke?" But the face remained impenetrable. Tranquil and friendly, I spoke of other things and admired the guns. Nevertheless, I noticed 3 loaded revolvers on the pieces of furniture, as if this man lived in constant fear of attack. I went there many times after that. Then for some time I did not go. We had become accustomed to his presence, and he had become indifferent to us. A whole year slipped away. Then one morning toward the end of November, my domestic awoke me with the announcement that Sir John Rowell had been assassinated in the night. A half hour later, I entered the Englishman's house with the central commissary and the captain of police. The servant, lost in despair, was weeping at the door. I suspected him at first, but afterward found that he was innocent. The guilty one could never be found. Upon entering Sir John's drawing room, I perceived his dead body stretched out upon its back in the middle of the room. His waistcoat was torn, a sleeve was hanging, and it was evident that a terrible struggle had taken place. The Englishman had been strangled. His frightfully black and swollen face seemed to express an abominable fear, and he held something between his set teeth and his neck, pierced with 5 holes apparently done with a pointed iron, was covered with blood. A doctor joined us. He examined closely the prints of fingers in the flesh and pronounced these strange words. One would think he had been strangled by a skeleton. A shiver ran down my back, and I cast my eyes to the place in the wall where I had seen the horrible torn-off hand. It was no longer there. The chain was broken and hanging. Then I bent over the dead man and found in his mouth a piece of one of the fingers of the missing hand, cut off, or rather sawed off, by the teeth exactly at the second joint. Then they tried to collect evidence. They could find nothing. No door had been forced, no window opened, or piece of furniture moved. The two watchdogs on the premises had not been aroused. Here, in a few words, is the deposition of the servant. For a month, his master had seemed agitated. He had received many letters which he had burned immediately. Often taking a whip in anger which seemed like dementia, he had struck in fury, this dried hand fastened to the wall and taken, one knew not how, at the moment of a crime. He had retired late and shut himself in with care. He always carried arms. Often in the night he talked out loud, as if he were quarreling with someone. On that night, however, there had been no noise, and it was only on coming to open the windows that the servant had found Sir John assassinated. He suspected no one. I communicated what I knew of the death to the magistrates and public officers, and they made minute inquiries upon the whole island. They discovered nothing. One night, 3 months after the crime, I had a frightful nightmare. It seemed to me that I saw that hand, that horrible hand, running like a scorpion or a spider along my curtains and my walls. 3 times I awoke, 3 times I fell asleep, and again I saw that hideous relic galloping about my room, moving its fingers like paws. The next day, they brought it to me, found in the cemetery upon the tomb where Sir John Rowell was interred, for I had not been able to find his family. The index finger was missing. This, ladies, is my story. I know no more about it. The ladies were terrified, pale, and shivering. One of them cried. But that is not the end, for there was no explanation. We cannot sleep if you do not tell us what was your idea of the reason of it all. The magistrate smiled with severity and answered, Oh, certainly, ladies, but it will spoil all your terrible dreams. I simply think that the legitimate proprietor of the hand was not dead, and that he came for it with the one that remained to him. But I was never able to find out how he did it. It was one kind of revenge. One of the women murmured, No, it could not be thus. And the judge of information, smiling, still concluded, I told you in the beginning that my explanation would not satisfy you. The Feather Pillow by Horacio Quiroga. Alicia's entire honeymoon gave her hot and cold shivers. A blonde, angelic, and timid young girl, the childhood fancy she had dreamed about being a bride had been chilled by her husband's rough character. She loved him very much, nonetheless, although sometimes she gave a light shudder when, as they returned home through the streets together at night, she cast furtive glances at the impressive stature of her Jordan, who had been silent for an hour. He for his part loved her profoundly, but never let it be seen. For 3 months, they had been married in April, they lived in a special kind of bliss. Doubtless she would have wished less severity in the rigorous sky of love, more expansive and less cautious tenderness, but her husband's impassive nature always restrained her. The house in which they lived influenced her chills and shuddering to no small degree. The whiteness of the silent patio, friezes, columns, and marble statues produced the wintry impression of an enchanted palace. Inside the glacial brilliance of stucco, the completely bare walls affirmed the sensation of unpleasant coldness. As one crossed from one room to another, the echo of his steps reverberated throughout the house, as if long abandonment had sensitized its resonance. Alicia passed the autumn in this strange loveliness. She had determined, however, to cast a veil over her former dreams and live like a sleeping beauty in the hostile house, trying not to think about anything till her husband arrived each evening. It is not strange that she grew thin. She had a light attack of influenza that dragged on insidiously for days and days. After that, Alicia's health never returned. Finally, one afternoon, she was able to go into the garden, supported on her husband's arm. She looked around listlessly. Suddenly, Jordan, with deep tenderness, ran his hand very slowly over her head, and Alicia instantly burst into sobs, throwing her arms around his neck. For a long time she cried out all the fears she had kept silent, redoubling her weeping at Jordan's slightest caress. Then her sobs subsided, and she stood a long while, her face hidden in the hollow of his neck, not moving or speaking a word. This was the last day Alicia was well enough to be up. The following day she awakened feeling faint. Jordan's doctor examined her with minute attention, prescribing calm and absolute rest. "I don't know," he said to Jordan at the street door. "She has a great weakness that I am unable to explain, and with no vomiting, nothing. If she wakes tomorrow, as she did today, call me at once." When she awakened the following day, Alicia was worse. There was a consultation. It was agreed there was anemia of incredible progression, completely inexplicable. Alicia had no more fainting spells, but she was visibly moving towards death. The lights were lighted all day long in her bedroom, and there was complete silence. Hours went by without the slightest sound. Alicia dozed. Jordan virtually lived in the drawing room, which was also always lighted. With tireless persistence, he paced ceaselessly from one end of the room to the other. The carpet swallowed his steps. At times he entered the bedroom and continued his silent pacing back and forth alongside the bed, stopping for an instant at each end to regard his wife. Suddenly Alicia began to have hallucinations, vague images at first seeming to float in the air, then descending to floor level. Her eyes excessively wide, she stared continuously at the carpet on either side of the bed. One night, she suddenly focused on one spot. Then she opened her mouth to scream, and pearls of sweat suddenly beaded her nose and lips. "Jordan! Jordan!" she clamored, rigid with fright, still staring at the carpet. Jordan ran to the bedroom, and when she saw him appear, Alicia screamed with terror. "It's I, Alicia! It's I!" Alicia looked at him confusedly. She looked at the carpet. She looked at him once again. And after a long moment of stupefied confrontation, she regained her senses. She smiled and took her husband's hand in hers, caressing it, trembling for half an hour. Amongst her most persistent hallucination was that of an anthropoid poised on his fingertips on the carpet, staring at her. The doctor's return put to no avail. They saw before them a diminishing life, a life bleeding away day by day, hour by hour, absolutely without their knowing why. During the last consultation, Alicia lay in a stupor, while they took her pulse, passing her inert wrist from one to another. They observed her a long time in silence and then moved into the dining room. "Phew," the discouraged chief physician shrugged his shoulders. "It's inexplicable. This case, there's little we can do." "That's my last hope," Jordan groaned. He staggered blindly against the table. Alicia's life was fading away in the subdelirium of anemia, a delirium which grew worse throughout the evening hours, but which let up somewhat after dawn. The illness never worsened during the daytime, but each morning she awakened pale as death, almost in a swoon. It seemed only at night that her life drained out of her in new waves of blood. Always, when she awakened, she had the sensation of lying collapsed in the bed with a million-pound weight on top of her. Following the third day of this relapse, she never left her bed again. She could scarcely move her head. She did not want her bed to be touched, not even to have her bed covers arranged. Her crepuscular terrors advanced, now in the form of monsters that dragged themselves towards the bed and laboriously climbed upon the bedspread. Then she lost consciousness. The final 2 days she raved ceaselessly in a weak voice. The lights funerally illuminated the bedroom and drawing room. In the deathly silence of the house, the only sound was the monotonous delirium from the bedroom and the dull echoes of Jordan's eternal pacing. Finally, Alicia died. The servant, when she came in afterward to strip the now empty bed, stared wonderingly for a moment at the pillow. "Sir," she called to Jordan in a low voice, "there are stains on the pillow that look like blood." Jordan approached rapidly and bent over the pillow. Truly on the case on both sides of the hollow, left by Alicia's head, were two small dark spots. "They look like punctures," the servant murmured after a moment of motionless observation. "Hold it up to the light," Jordan told her. The servant raised the pillow, but immediately dropped it and stood staring at it, livid and trembling. Without knowing why, Jordan felt the hair rise in the back of his neck. "What is it?" he murmured in a hoarse voice. "It's very heavy," the servant whispered, still trembling. Jordan picked it up. It was extraordinarily heavy. He carried it out of the room, and on the dining room he ripped open the case and the tickling with a slash. The top feathers floated away, and the servant, her mouth open wide, gave a scream of horror and covered her face with clenched fists. In the bottom of the pillowcase, among the feathers slowly moving its hairy legs, was a monstrous animal, a living viscous ball. It was so swollen one could barely make out its mouth. Night after night, since Alicia had taken to her bed, this abomination had stealthily applied its mouth, its proboscis, one might better say, to the girl's temples, sucking her blood. The puncture was scarcely perceptible. The daily plumping of the pillow had doubtlessly at first impeded its progress, but as soon as the girl could no longer move, the suction became fortuitous. In 5 days, in 5 nights, the monster had drained Alicia's life away. These parasites of feathered creatures, diminutive in their habitual environments, reach enormous proportions under certain circumstances. Human blood seems particularly favorable to them, and it is not rare to encounter them in feather pillows. The Figure in the Mirage by Robert S. Hitchens. On a windy night of spring, I sat by a great fire that had been built by Moors on a plain of Morocco under the shadow of a white city, and talked with a fellow countryman, stranger to me till that day. We had met in the morning in a filthy alley of the town, and had foregathered. He was a wanderer for pleasure like myself, and learning that he was staying in a dreary hostelry haunted by fever, I invited him to dine in my camp and to pass the night in one of the small peaked tents that served me and my Moorish attendants as home. He consented gladly. Dinner was over, no bad one, for Moors can cook, can even make delicious caramel pudding in desert places. And Mohammed, my stalwart valet de chambre, had given us most excellent coffee. Now we smoked by the great fire, looked up at the marvelously bright stars, and told, as is the ways of travelers, tales of our wanderings. My companion, whom I took at first to be a rather ironic, skeptical, and by nature unimaginative globetrotter, he was a hard-looking, iron-gray man of middle age, related the usual tiger story, the time-honored elephant anecdote, and a couple of snake yarns of no special value, and I was beginning to fear that I should get little entertainment from so prosaic a sportsman, when I chanced to mention the desert. "Ah," said my guest, taking his pipe from his mouth, "the desert is the strangest thing in nature, as woman is the strangest thing in human nature, and when you get them together, desert and woman, by Jove." He paused, and he shot a keen glance at me. "Ever been in the Sahara?" he said. I replied in the affirmative, but added that I had as yet only seen the fringe of it. "Biskra, I suppose," he rejoined, "and the nearest oasis, Sidi Okba, and so on?" I nodded. I saw I was in for another tale, and anticipated some history of shooting exploits under the salt mountain of Altaya. "Well," he continued, "I know the Sahara pretty fairly, and about the oddest thing I ever could believe in, I heard of and believed in there." "Something about a gazelle?" I queried. "Gazelle? No. A woman," he replied. As he spoke, a Moor glided out of the windy darkness and threw an armful of dry reeds on the fire. The fire flared up vehemently, and I saw that the face of my companion had changed. The hardness of it was smoothed away. Some memory that held its romance sat with him. "A woman," he repeated, knocking the ashes out of his pipe, almost sentimentally. "More than that. A French woman of Paris, with a nameless charm, the chic, the... But I'll tell you. Some years ago, 3 Parisians, a man, his wife, and her unmarried sister, a girl of 18, with an angel and a devil in her dark beauty, came to a great resolve. They decided that they were tired of the Francais, sick of the bois, bored to death with the boulevards, that they wanted to see for themselves the famous French colonies which were forever being talked about in the chamber. They determined to travel. No sooner was the determination come to than they were off. Hotel de Colonies, Marseille, steamboat Le General Chancy, 5 o'clock on a splendid sunny afternoon, Algiers with its terraces, its white villas, its palm trees, and its safis. But," I began. He foresaw my objection. "There were Safis, and that's the point of my story. Some fete was out in the town while our Parisians were there. All the African troops were out, Zouaves, Chasseurs, Tirailleurs. The governor went in procession to perform some ceremony and in front of his carriage rode 16 Safis, probably got in from that desert camp of theirs near El Taya. All this was long before the Tsar visited Paris, and our Parisians had never before seen the dashing Safis, had only heard of them, of their magnificent horses, their turbans and flowing Arab robes, their gorgeous figures, lustrous eyes, and diabolic horsemanship. You know how they ride. No cavalry to touch them, not even the Cossacks. Well, our French friends were struck. The unmarried sister more especially was bouleversée by these glorious demons. As they caracoled beneath the balcony on which she was leaning, she clapped her little hands in their white kid gloves and threw down a shower of roses. The falling flowers frightened the horses. They pranced, bucked, reared. One Safi, a great fellow, eyes like a desert eagle, grand aquiline no profile, on whom three roses had dropped, looked up, saw Mademoiselle, call her Valerie, gazing down with her great bright eyes. They were deuced fine eyes, by Jove. "You've seen her," I asked, and flashed a smile at her with his white teeth. It was his last day in the service. He was in grand spirits. "Mon Dieu, ma cadence," she sang out. Her people laughed at her. The Spahi looked at her again, not smiling. She shrank back on the balcony. Then his place was taken by the governor, small imperial chapeau de forme, evening dress, landau, and pair. Mademoiselle was desolée. Why couldn't civilized men look like Safis? Why were all Parisians commonplace? Why, why? Her sister and brother-in-law called her the savage worshipper and took her down to the café on the terrace to dine. And all through dinner, Mademoiselle talked of the beaux Safis, in the plural, with a secret reservation in her heart. After Algiers, our Parisians went by way of Constantine to Biskra. Now they saw desert for the first time. The curious iron-gray, velvety brown, and rose-pink mountains, the nomadic Arabs camping in their earth-colored tents, patched with rags, the camels against the skyline, the everlasting sands, broken here and there by the deep green shadows of distant oases, where the close-growing palms, seen from far off, give to the desert almost the effect that clouds give to Cornish waters. At Biskra, Mademoiselle, oh, what she must have looked like under the mimosa trees before the Hotel de l'Oasis.
"Then you've seen her," I began.
Mademoiselle became enthusiastic again, and almost before they knew it, her sister and brother-in-law were committed to a desert expedition, were fitted out with the dragoman, tents, mules, the whole show, in fact, and one blazing hot day found themselves out in that sunshine. You know it, with Biskra a green shadow on that sea, the mountains behind the sulfur springs turning from bronze to black-brown in the distance, and the table flatness of the desert stretching ahead of them to the limits of the world and the judgment day. My companion paused, took a flaming reed from the fire, put it to his pipe bowl, pulled hard at his pipe, all the time staring straight before him, as if among the glowing logs, he saw the caravan of the Parisians winding onward across the desert sands. Then he turned to me side and said, "You've seen mirage?" "Yes," I answered. "Have you noticed that in mirage, the things one fancies one sees generally appear in large numbers? Buildings crowded as in towns, trees growing together as in woods, men shoulder to shoulder in large companies. My experience of mirage in the desert was so, and I acknowledged it. Have you ever seen in a mirage a solitary figure?" he continued. I thought for a moment. Then I replied in the negative. "No more have I," he said, "and I believe it's a very rare occurrence. Now mark the mirage that showed itself to Mademoiselle on the first day of the desert journey of the Parisians. She sat on the northern verge of the oasis of Sidi Akba. Late in the afternoon, as they journeyed to Har, their dragoman, he had applied for the post and got it by the desire of Mademoiselle, who admired his lithe bearing and gorgeous aplomb. Tahar suddenly pulled up his mule, pointed with his brown hand to the horizon, and said in French, 'There is mirage, look. There is the mirage of the great desert.' Our Parisians, filled with excitement, gazed above the pointed ears of their beasts over the shimmering waste. There, beyond the palms of the oasis, wrapped in a mysterious hay, lay the mirage. They looked at it in silence.
Then Mademoiselle cried in her little bird's clear voice, "Mirage! But surely he's real!"
"What does Mademoiselle see?" asked Zahar quickly.
"Why, a sort of faint landscape, through which a man, an Arab, I suppose, is riding towards Sidi.
What is it?
Sidi Akba. He's got something in front of him, hanging across his saddle." Her relations looked at her in amazement.
"I only see houses standing on the edge of water," said her sister.
"And I," cried the husband.
"Houses and water," assented Tahar.
"It is always so in the mirage of Sidi Akba."
"I see no houses, no water," cried Mademoiselle, straining her eyes.
"The Arab rides fast like the wind. He's in a hurry. One would think he was being pursued. Why, now he's gone."
She turned to her companions. They saw still the fairy houses of the mirage standing in the haze on the edge of the fairy water.
"But," Mademoiselle said impatiently, "there's nothing at all now, only sand."
"Mademoiselle dreams," said Tahar. "The mirage is always there."
They rode forward. That night they camped near Sidi Akba. At dinner, while the stars came out, they talked of the mirage, and Mademoiselle still insisted that it was a mirage of a horseman bearing something before him on his saddle bow and riding as if for life. And Tahar said again, "Mademoiselle dreams." As he spoke, he looked at her with a mysterious intentness, which she noticed. That night, in her little camp bed, round which the desert winds blew mildly, she did indeed dream, and her dream was of the magic forms that ride on magic horses through mirage. The next day at dawn, the caravan of the Parisians went on its way, winding further into the desert. In leaving Sidi Akba, they left behind them the last traces of civilization. The French man and woman who kept the Abrage in the orange garden there, today as they journeyed, a sense of deep mystery flowed upon the heart of Mademoiselle. She felt that she was a little cockle-shell of a boat, which, accustomed hitherto only to the scene, now sailed upon a mighty ocean. The fear of the Sahara came upon her. My companion paused. His face was grave, almost stern. "And her relations," I asked, "did they feel?"
"Haven't an idea what they felt," he answered curtly.
"But how do you know that, Mademoiselle?"
"You'll understand at the end of the story." As they journeyed in the sun across the endless flats, for the mountains had vanished now, and nothing broke the level of the sand, Mademoiselle's gaiety went from her. Silent was the lively chattering tongue that knew the jargon of cities, the gossip of the plage. She was oppressed. Tahar rode close at her side. He seemed to have taken her under his special protection. Far before them rode the attendants, chanting deep love songs in the sun. The sound of those songs seemed like the sound of the great desert, singing of its wild and savage love to the heart of Mademoiselle. At first her brother-in-law and sister bantered her on her silence, but Tahar stopped them with a curious authority.
"The desert speaks to Mademoiselle," he said in her hearing. "Let her listen."
He watched her continually with his huge eyes, and she did not mind his glance, though she began to feel irritated and restless under the observation of her relations. Towards noon Tahar again described mirage. As he pointed it out, he stared fixedly at Mademoiselle. The two other Parisians exclaimed that they saw forest trees, a running stream, a veritable oasis, where they longed to rest and eat their déjeuner.
"And Mademoiselle," said Tahar, "what does she see?"
She was gazing into the distance. Her face was very pale, and for a moment she did not answer. Then she said,
"I see again the Arab bearing the burden before him on the saddle. He is much clearer than yesterday. I can almost see his face."
She paused. She was trembling.
"But I cannot see what he carries. It seems to float on the wind like a robe or a woman's dress. Oh, mon Dieu, how fast he rides."
She stared before her as if fascinated, and following with her eyes some rapidly moving object, suddenly she shut her eyes.
"He's gone," she said.
"And now, Mademoiselle sees," said Tahar. She opened her eyes.
"Nothing."
"Yet the mirage is still there," he said.
"Valerie," cried her sister, "are you mad that you see what no one else can see and cannot see what all else see?"
"Am I mad, Tahar?" she said gravely, almost timidly, to the dragoman. And the fear of the Sahara came again upon her.
"Mademoiselle sees what she must," he answered. "The desert speaks to the heart of Mademoiselle." That night there was no moon. Mademoiselle could not sleep. She lay in her narrow bed and thought of the figure in the mirage, while the moonbeam stole in between the tent pegs to keep her company. She thought of second sight, of phantoms, and of wraiths. Was this riding Arab, whom she alone could see a phantom of the Sahara, mysteriously accompanying the caravan, and revealing himself to her through the medium of the mirage, as if in a magic mirror? She turned restlessly upon her pillow, saw the knotty moonbeams, got up, and went swiftly to the tent door. All the desert was bathed in light. She gazed out as a mariner gazes out over the sea. She heard jackals yelping in the distance, peevish in their insomnia, and fancied their voices were the voices of desert demons. As she stood there, she thought of the figure in the mirage, and wondered if mirage ever rises at night, if by chance she might see it now. And while she stood wondering, far away across the sand there floated up a silvery haze, like a veil of spangled tissue, exquisite for a ball rope, she said long after. And in this haze she saw again the phantom Arab galloping upon his horse. But now he was clear in the moon. Furiously he rode like a thing demented in a dream, and as he rode, he looked back over his shoulder as if he feared pursuit. Mademoiselle could see his fierce eyes, like the eyes of a desert eagle, that stared unwinking at the glaring African sun. He urged on his fleet horse. She could hear now the ceaseless thud of its hoofs upon the hard sand as it drew nearer and nearer. She could see the white foam upon its steaming flanks, and now at last she knew that the burden which the Arab bore across his saddle and supported with his arms was a woman. Her robe flew out upon the wind. Her dark loose hair streamed over the breast of the horseman. Her face was hidden against his heart. But Mademoiselle saw his face, uttered a cry, and shrank back against the canvas of the tent. For it was the face of the Swahi, who had ridden in the procession of the governor, of the Swahi to whom she had thrown the rose from the balcony of Algiers. As she cried out, the mirage faded. The Arab vanished, the thud of the horse's hooves died in her ears, and Tahar, the dragoman, glided round the tent and stood before her. His eyes gleamed in the moonlight like ebon jewels. "Hush," he whispered. Mademoiselle sees the mirage. Mademoiselle could not speak. She stared into the eyes of Tahar, and hers were dilated with wonder. He drew nearer to her. "Mademoiselle has seen again the horseman and his burden." She bowed her head. All things seemed dreamlike to her. Tahar's voice was low and monotonous and sounded far away. "It is fate," he said. He paused, gazing upon her. "In the tents they all sleep," he murmured. "Even the watchman sleeps, for I have given him a powder of hashish, and hashish gives long dreams, long dreams." From beneath his robe he drew a small box, opened it, and showed to Mademoiselle a dark brown powder, which he shook into a tiny cup of water. "Mademoiselle shall drink, as the watchman has drunk," he said, "shall drink and dream." He held the cup to her lips, and she, fascinated by his eyes, as by the eyes of a mesmerist, could not disobey him. She swallowed the hashish, swayed, and fell forward into his arms. A moment later, across the spaces of the desert, whitened by the moon, rode the figure Mademoiselle had seen in the mirage. Upon his saddle bore a dreaming woman, and in the ears of the woman, through all that night, beat the thunderous music of a horse's hoofs spurning the desert sand. Mademoiselle had taken her place in the vision, which she no longer saw. My companion paused. His pipe had gone out. He did not relight it, but sat looking at me in silence. "The Spahi?" I asked. "I claimed the giver of the roses." "And Tahar?" "The shots he fired after the Spahi missed fire. Yet Tahar was a notable shot." "A strange tale," I said. "How did you come to hear it?" "A year ago I penetrated very far into the Sahara on a sporting expedition. One day I came upon an encampment of nomads. The story was told me by one of them as we sat in the low doorways of an earth-colored tent and watched the sun go down." "Told you by an Arab?" He shook his head. "By whom, then?" "By a woman, with a clear little bird's voice, with an angel and a devil in her dark beauty, a woman with a gesture of Paris, the grace, the diablerie of Paris." Light broke on me. "By Mademoiselle?" I exclaimed. "Pardon," he answered, "by Madame. She was married to the figure in the mirage, and she was content Content, I cried. Content with her two little dark children dancing before her in the twilight, content with the figure of the mirage galloping in evening across the plain, shouting an eastern love song with a gazelle, instead of a woman, slung across a saddle bow. Did I not say that, as the desert is the strangest thing in nature, so a woman is the strangest thing in human nature? Which heart is most mysterious? Its heart, I asked, or the heart of Mademoiselle? I give the palm to the latter. And I, he answered, taking off his wide-brimmed hat. I gave it when I saluted her as Madame before the tent door, out there in the great desert.